Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy. Yeah. Right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
You know, there were lots of moments where we were like, oh my God, like we should not have messed with these people. Like, we were trying to kind of prank people and like, oh, you think that we're Baby Shambles rock stars, so we're gonna like get wasted and act like that. And then it's like, oh, now it's on like a newspaper the next day. so we had to stop doing that pretty quickly.
Hey, how you doing, Greg?
I'm good, thanks, Stu. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Hello to everyone listening. Thank you for downloading this episode of Midnight Chats, the late night interview podcast where Greg and I get to meet some of our favourite musicians every week. Tonight's guests on the show are two people who, Greg, you have a very deep and personal relationship with.
I guess so. Deep and personal, or just met them a long time ago?
Yeah, I'm being a bit facetious there. The reason I say that is because tonight's guest is MGMT, the American duo MGMT, who I must admit, it's not that I've not been a fan of this band. I've just never really listened to them, if I'm totally honest, other than the huge hits that everyone will know, Kids, Time to Pretend, Electric Feel. Mm. Beyond that, I am struggling a little bit. You were there from the beginning. You interviewed them when they came to London way back.
I did. I interviewed them on one of their very first trips to the UK when they were first playing shows over here, 2007. And so it was nice to get to speak to them again and remind myself that that was a long time ago.
What I really enjoyed when I listened to this was a few things, actually. But ultimately, MGMT were quite a party band back then, weren't they? They were known for enjoying the good things in life and some substances, shall we say. And I did get the feeling, Greg, that a lot of the time they couldn't remember anything at all. And I think there were times when you were asking questions and I could hear them thinking, I don't know what this guy's talking about here.
I actually thought their recall was pretty good, considering. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about an era here where MGMT were releasing, like you say, Kids, Electric Feel, songs like Time to Pretend, which lots of people would have heard recently on the Saltburn soundtrack. And yeah, it was a huge time for them when they kind of emerged. They were suddenly supporting Paul McCartney in baseball stadiums and meeting Arctic Monkeys, etc., etc., both of which they talk about in this podcast. And the reason we were talking to them is because they recently released their fifth album, Loss of Life, back in February, which is amazing. You said that you haven't listened to them too much like of recent times. I think this is their best album, and it's got two of my favorite MGMT songs on. It's got People in the Streets and Nothing Changes, both of which I urge people to go and check out because I think they're amazing. And they do still have that sort of shy, introverted, mischievous, like offbeat sense of humor where you're not actually quite sure whether what they're telling you is true or not. Like the story that Andrew tells in this about Adele singing him happy birthday. And we revisit some good stories.
I'm not sure if he knows if that was true.
I know. I think that goes back to your earlier point about how much they were taking in at that point. Before we get into this, Stu, I'm mindful that we need to do a quick TikTok update after we spoke about it on last week's King Gizzard introduction.
Yeah, it's not good, Greg. I think they might be going down.
I didn't even realise that was a thing that could happen.
Yeah, the TikTok's not going well, but it's still there. If you'd like to follow us, it's Midnight Chats Pod. Instagram's going better. There's some stuff on Instagram. And I'll tell you what is on Instagram, actually. There's a picture of us from around the time you would have first interviewed MGMT, 2007. That's something that I just happened to post a while ago, but it is there in the grid. So if you want to see how Greg and I used to look, Greg looked a lot worse and I looked a lot better. That's what we've come up with from that. That's all that's to us. Here is... on episode 126 of Midnight Chats. Is it?
Think.
It's Greg Cochran talking to MGMT.
Ben, it was your birthday yesterday, wasn't it?
It was.
It was. It was. That was my internet research told me that. I'm not like a kind of a creepy stalker.
Like, how did you know?
I know. Did you have a good one? Happy birthday.
Thank you. I just turned 41, which is, it feels like the most uneventful birthday in a way, which I really enjoy.
Did you do something eventful for your 40th? Did you go big on that one?
I did a woodworking class yesterday, like an intro to woodworking, which was really fun.
What did you make?
I made a cutting board, so basically a block of wood, but it's it's cool. It was really fun, like working on the big tools and learning how to, like, you know, perfectly square the corners and stuff like that. It was fun.
Dare I ask, Andrew, do you do presents to each other on each other's birthdays?
We did for our 40th, both of our last year. Well, I know I forced our managers to like go in on this big present, and I was really happy about that. And it's great. Ben loves it.
Yeah, it's a really
piece of furniture,
really
actually.
Nice chair, like a very classy kind of lounge chair that it looks like you should be like smoking a pipe sitting in it or something like that.
That feels so adult for like 40, isn't it? Like, I got a really nice chair. What did you get for your, are you 40, Andrew? What did you get for your 40th?
So for my 40th, it was like a joint present with Ben and our managers and my wife, and they chipped in and got like a projector screen and projector for our house. So we have like a little home cinema set up now.
Well, I'm super excited to speak to you both because we have met once before, and I was looking back at the dates in the run-up to this, and it was November 2007, which, much to my horror, is like 17 years ago.
Oh my God.
It was backstage at a venue called Coco in London. We were young and we were fresh, and I feel like Andrew, you might have been wearing like a cape on stage that night or something like that. Could that be possible?
That sounds highly likely.
It's very possible. Yeah, probably like a cape and like leggings was like kind of go to back then.
You were playing on a bill with some other bands. One of them I can remember, which was the Cortinas, who are a British band who are still going now. But yeah, what are your memories from those like first tours, those first like movements outside of the States?
That's not the venue that had like the like giant disco ball, is it?
It is. And it's like, there's like a dome. So from the outside, it looks like an old theater and there's a big dome. And then inside there's like the floor and then maybe like three tiers where people would be stood watching the bands. Yeah.
Cause I remember, I'm pretty sure that following winter, we played there when we were on tour with Florence and the Machine. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember the backstage being this like very like little like narrow stairways up to like dressing rooms and stuff. Yeah.
That's exactly it.
I don't remember too much about that time period though. So that's kind of impressive.
Impressive that you don't remember.
That I do remember that. I remember there's a disco ball.
Yeah, you're pleased with the recollection on that. what about you, Ben? What were your memories of sort of,
you know, basically the band going abroad for the first time, did it feel overwhelming? Did it take it in your stride? Was it just sort of like, I mean, I remember you both being like fairly relaxed.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, it was, I mean, it was a wild time for us because so many things were happening for the first time. And I think, I mean, we didn't have like the normal trajectory of having like been in a band for a long time, just like doing the whole like touring and everything before things really blew up. So it was like it was all happening in real time, just right in that moment. And and I don't know if I think probably a lot of people who talked to us around that time didn't really like realize that or like fully realize that about us. So I think, you know, probably a lot of the ways in which we came across as pretty strange in that at that point in time, like could be attributed to that. Also just us being weird people in general, but yeah.
When I think of back on it, it seems like we both had this, this kind of smug quality because we thought that it was all just going to totally vanish. And that this was kind of just like, you know, there's no way this would actually last. It was so ridiculous. And suddenly we're in England having just been, you know, touring in a van. And I don't know, it's just like, it all felt like a kind of surreal joke. And then, you know, over the course of the next year, it quickly became less of a joke.
Yeah.
For better or for worse.
And I just remember, like, speaking from the UK perspective, like lots of the music publications were trying to sort of box MGMT in or describe what you were doing. So like at one time you were like, you were indie. Another time you were like new rave. Another time you were sort of like this new wave of like psychedelic pop music. And like they were all, you know, basically, you know, when music journalists are struggling to describe what an artist sounds like when they reach for words like oddball or like oddball pop or something like that. And did you find all that quite funny at the time as people were trying to sort of like characterize you and what you did?
It was funny in the same sense that I was just saying, where it's like, it's funny, like, oh my God, like how are we in this situation now where the British, you know, tabloid media is coming up with ideas and stories about us. So I think we had fun playing into their expectations and kind of like foiling them if we could. But then also quickly realized that we were like way overpowered. Like that there were lots of moments where we were like, oh my God, like we should not have messed with these people. Like we were trying to kind of prank people and like, oh, you think that we're, you know, Baby Shambles rock stars, so we're gonna like get wasted and act like that. And then it's like, oh, now it's on like a newspaper the next day. Like, so we had to stop doing that pretty quickly. It just definitely, in lots of ways, it forced us to change our approach to music and what we were doing.
Well, there was a lot going on. I mean, it did feel like in some ways there was like a combination of like being sort of built up by journalists to be this like kind of this contrived like thing that like, you know, either like fit into a box or fit into a scene or something like that, which is wild to us because I think we were just like doing what we were doing and didn't feel attached to a particular scene or something. And the other side of it too was it felt like, in some ways it felt like we were being built up just so that we could be taken down. You know, I think, as you know, happens with a lot of like movements in popular culture where it's like, you know, there's this thing that's huge and then it's like, oh, that's really not cool anymore. And now this other thing is the thing. And, you know, I guess I'm grateful that after, you know, however many years that we're still here. And I think part of it is just that we were able to not take that stuff too seriously.
It's like we were on little jet skis and we were like, there's like this giant like tanker ship and we were going around like, la, 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 la. And then like, they're like, oh yeah, like we're a freaking huge tanker. And we were just like, oh, let's get out of here. And we just like, then we hid and went away.
I'm sure it's just the same in the States, but the British press are particularly well known for that kind of backstab, basically. I mean, 18 months after you played that Coco show, you were supporting Paul McCartney in Boston. Like, it was a wild couple of years for you.
He needed our support too. He wasn't doing that well. Yeah. We really propped him up in a moment.
Although he was bigging up MGMT in the press at that time, which, you know, is always a sense that, like, you know you're doing something right when somebody like Paul McCartney is talking about you as like an artist that they love because they want to kind of be associated with the latest thing.
That's insanity. Yeah.
Those shows, what were they like? What do you recall from that?
It was one show. It was at Fenway Park in Boston, and I don't know. I remember, like, we met Paul McCartney, and I mean, it was like this kind of like, Paul will see you now, like this very like arranged. Like, but he was very
an
like,
audience of Paul McCartney.
Yeah, it did felt a little bit like having like an audience with a king or something like that. But also like he was very like in that moment seemed very like genuinely present and took time away from whatever he was doing to and like had like a very like warm like nice handshake and very sincere
for 9 seconds. Yeah.
But yeah.
I remember there was really terrible manicotti in the catering because it was like all vegan. I think all of his catering is vegan. And I was just like, oh man, like this sucks. I don't want to eat this. And then I remember my family was there, like my mom and I think my sister, and we were hanging out and it was just really fun. We were in the hotel where we were staying and the Arctic Monkeys were there. And we hung out and we're having oysters and drinks, and my mom and Alex Turner were like really getting along well, and it was just like so fun.
Still in touch now, still chatting.
Yeah, they're still talking. Yeah,
I'm glad to hear that you kind of had a very sort of like level, not take it too seriously kind of mentality, because you were at the Brits, you were heading to the Grammys. It was all of this like incredibly surreal stuff happening.
Well, one distinct memory I have from around then was that there was some, I guess it was like a party at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and like on our way, like in a cab or something, and somebody like, we're like just walking in and somebody, and this was like when Los Angeles was like a foreign concept to me. Like I live here now. It's a very like normal place to me. But when we were coming here on tour and whatever, it was always just like, this is the most like cuckoo place in the world. Like what even is this city? And we're walking in.
It's still like that to me, by the way. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, we're like walking into this swanky party and somebody's like talking about Ron Jeremy for some reason, like just his name comes up. You're like, just as we're walking into the building, Ron Jeremy is like lounging on the sofa in the middle of the lobby of the Beverly Hills Hotel. And that moment, I feel like that kind of broke my brain. I was just like, what is
and
what
Lindsay
is
going Lohan on was there. Yeah. And we went to a Grammys after party for Columbia, our label. And it was my birthday, or like right around my birthday. Adele sang Happy Birthday to me. That's crazy.
That is incredible.
You can't make that shit up.
You need to tell, how did that come about? Was she just like on your table? And
Yeah, she was in like our booth area. It's probably not as, I'm doubt she sang the whole song, but in my mind, after like 75 years after the experience, Adele saying Happy Birthday to me. Maybe we could ask her one day if that actually happened.
Yeah. I'm trying to think back as well. So if this is like 2010, is Adele like a global megastar at this point? I guess she probably is, right?
Not like mega. I don't think like right before.
Still though, that's a hell of a claim.
Yeah, I know. Let's hope it's true.
All of this was happening around the release of the debut album, Miraculous Spectacular. And last year you played that album in full at the Just Like Heaven Festival in Pasadena, is it? How did that feel?
Yeah, it was the first time we've done it. And It was really cool because we kind of took it as this opportunity. I mean, especially like we hadn't played a live show at that point in years. And I think we'd sort of been distancing ourselves from the idea of the sort of like nostalgia festival, like revisiting, you know, we didn't want it to feel like we're reflecting on our dinosaur of a career that doesn't exist anymore or something. And, but I think we took it as an opportunity to sort of have a sense of humor about that. And like, we worked with a friend who like writes for comedy and sort of like, we wrote little skits in the middle and like, I ended up having a really good time with it. And I think in some ways like reconnected with the spirit of the band when we started, like before things really blew up. And we also had, so we dug up all of our original demo recordings from Oracular Spectacular. And we actually used a lot of them in the show where, kind of like formed new tracks out of them and stuff like that.
That was fun. Like just even seeing the names that we would give to different tracks in a recording session, they would always, you know, these like really silly little inside jokes back then. And it's sort of like a time capsule to open it up.
One-off thing, you'd be tempted to do it again? Or was it just like, it was fun just as something to do and then move on?
I don't know. I mean, we put a lot of work into that show, like kind of an unreasonable amount of work where I think like maybe a more sensible person would have just been like, take the check and just do it. Yeah. But we were like, oh, like they gave us like a good budget to put on this show. And we just like put a ton of time and effort into the production and we did like dress rehearsals and stuff like that. And then it's like, you know, it was so much work, like so much work. And then it was just done. And now we're, you know, working on releasing a new album. So we've kind of been putting more energy into that and haven't really visited the idea of doing that Oracular Spectacular thing again. But it would be cool. It would be a cool thing to do.
I'd love to do it again.
You should do it as like a Broadway residency or a Las Vegas residency.
We have slightly tongue-in-cheek approached that subject. I mean, it'd be incredible. But I don't know.
I think it would be awesome.
Yeah.
I really was getting into the sort of that different style of rehearsing and where it's like a production and there's like set changes and costume changes and scene changes and like lines and all this stuff. Like I never was much in the theater. I was like a little boy in Bye Bye Birdie when I was 10 or something. but I was like, oh, this is nice. Like I like this whole kind of communal group production thing. It's nice.
100%. Some of the best stuff I've ever seen. Like I saw David Byrne play like 5 years ago. The name of the tour has escaped me now, but it was basically that sort of like highly choreographed, kind of like three sides of a box kind of stage set, like everything moving between all the live players, even the drummers were like wearing their instruments and so they were moving around the stage. And the whole thing had like a narrative. And I was like, this is just so imaginative. Like there's a lot of value to just stuff being like, let's just try something completely different. I mean, it's David Byrne and obviously he knows what he's doing, but I love that creativity.
I think also there's something too about, I think when I see like a band performing live now, there's such an element of like artifice to it where it is a production. And, you know, I mean, I feel like almost every band you see now is playing with backing tracks, which is like nothing against that. It's just like the way that things are, the way that people, you know, people expect things to sound like the record on stage or something like that. But then at that point, it's like, there's something dishonest about assuming like, oh, everything you see is happening live and like, it's this real thing. And like, why is that any more real than just like a straight up stage production with, you know, like, I don't know, to me, it's like more interesting to just lean into the stage production side of it and just like put on a show. Like that's cool.
Brilliant. We'll watch this space. I'm excited for that to happen.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I want to bring things kind of more up to date, or at least up to the last few years, because I want to ask you about the reception to the song Little Dark Age, which obviously went viral during the sort of COVID-19 pandemic. It was massive on TikTok. It was like a massive TikTok meme, wasn't it? And I read a stat this morning that basically it's soundtracked something like 5 million different videos of that people have like made themselves. And I just wanted to know what that feels like when you make a song and you just put it out there in the universe and then it just takes on this completely its own life, basically.
It was very humbling in a way. I mean, just to be like, you know, it's completely beyond our control. And, you know, and it was a while after we'd released that music too. So it wasn't like part of the album campaign or anything like that. Like it just happened.
Yeah. I think I felt a little bit like validated or you know, that was our first single and it was the title track from our last album, and we always felt like it was a strong, catchy song that like could connect with people. And it seemed like, you know, it went well when we released it, but the label wasn't really pushing it, or like it's like not as many people believed in it the way we did. And then in 2.5 or whatever years later, it kind of caught on and connected with tons of people. And it was kind of fun to just experience that. And it was totally unexpected and shocking.
Yeah. Is there anything, I mean, there's no way you'd have been able to keep track of like all of the ways it's been used, but had you seen anything that like particularly stuck in your mind where you were like, wow, it's being used like this?
Oh, I mean, there's lots of, along with the fun TikTok trends, neither of us is on TikTok or really social media that much, but I am aware that there's like one of the kind of lines that took that song and ran with it was this weird like online kind of like, isn't it like sort of like Proud Boy, like war nostalgia, like some weird like I don't know, neo-fascist thing happened with this song. And particularly with the, I think the like slowed down version or something. So like that was happening, but alongside these like really like kind of interesting, vibrant TikTok trends. I think the first one was like where people were posing like classical sculptures with the song. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Like that's, I wouldn't have thought that would happen. You know, I don't know. It's just like, we're just observing all of these things. And also just very happy that, our relationship with the song Kids has been, it's very complex. And we made that song when we were, 19, I think. And there's been times where we've been trying to just like get away from it and just hoping against hope that something could come and like take the attention away from it. And this Little Dark Age kind of did that. So we were a little bit relieved.
I don't suppose, have you played that many shows since it, like since that happened? Because I'd be interested to know, like, it's suddenly a massive song. So like, where does it sit in the kind of MGMT like set list now? Is it just like, it's one of the big ones, right?
We haven't played any, I mean, outside of the Just Like Heaven Festival, we have not played a single show since.
And we didn't play Little Dark Age at that festival, so.
Yeah. And we thought about playing it and we were kind of wondering like how that, like what that would be like to play live. Because yeah, the last time that we performed it live was in 2019.
So you don't really know what to expect for the next time you head out on the road, if you head out on the road.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Speaking of kind of like the surreal nature of the internet, I love whenever I'm feeling, whenever I need to reach for some like uninhibited joy, I always look to the clip of Kid Cudi dancing on stage with you to Electric Feel at Coachella.
Oh my gosh.
Like 6 years ago. It's just, I mean, obviously he kind of owned the
fact. I think it was actually almost 10 years ago.
Was it really? Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was 2014.
Okay. Time is getting away from all of us. I love that clip. It's just somebody who is just enjoying themselves to the absolute max.
It's true. He seemed very happy.
He was enjoying it way more than we were too. Like
I was going to say, how like, were you feeling as you saw him doing that?
Well, it wasn't.
No, I was enjoying him doing that. But like in terms of like playing on stage at Coachella, it's just like it's a little bit anxiety inducing. I think to be on like one of those main stages and. So that was nice. It was like somebody's coming out to like take the spotlight off of us for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about Loss of Life and like everything that's happening for you in 2024 with the new album. Bubblegum Dog is one of my favorite music videos for ages because it pays homage to like a whole bunch of classic rock videos from like the 90s. And I wanted to ask you about the research stage for that video because you obviously settled on a bunch of different videos that you wanted to kind of include, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, etc. But what when you were thinking of the ideas, like revisiting your, presumably it coming from like your growing up with MTV, you would like come home from like college or whatever, throw on MTV, watch like those music videos. So what was like the long list and how was that quite fun just thinking back to like, oh yeah, that was a video that I saw 100 times when I was 16.
Yeah. There was like, we had some really hilarious conference calls. We're talking with, like our friend Tom Sharpling, who also helped out with the Just Like Heaven Festival and who directed the video along with Julia Vickerman and I remember being on the phone with Tom and like just bringing up all of these videos and it was like he was like very like paying very close attention to all of the references, like things that we were just kind of saying off the cuff just on the phone, and I think just it was just like everything was very literally referenced in there, like he made sure that it was like everything we talked about was in there. It was a long list.
Compiling the list of like tropes from alternative and grunge videos from the 90s was so fun. I mean, the maniacally laughing old man in a fisheye lens, and then the oversaturated colors, the like small child in this, like, you know, the stretch lens small child and dripping, dirty, dripping sink, like random basketball rolling along. Like, there's just, we tried to just like check them all off, and it was so fun. That was the most fun I've ever had making a video.
It was such a throwback as well, because it was literally, it reminded me of like getting home from school, turning on MTV, and then later on it'd be like MTV2. And I mean, to be honest, I'm glad that like the sort of stuff of your era, it's like still has like loads of credibility. Cause like I was thinking like, oh, what do I think of first when I think of like throwing on MTV2? And I was like, Papa Roach videos, Limp Bizkit videos, Alien Ant Farm. And was like, that was like 3 years later. And like you hit 2000, like 1999, 2000, and like everything changed, right?
Yeah.
It's funny to me also to think about like people who see that video who were not around when that stuff was on MTV, and just like sort of like, what is this? Like, what is this artifact?
You've done well. Like, it's a brilliantly. I wasn't going to say it's subtle, because it's not subtle, but it's just like the perfect homage.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, right, which is different than empathy, yeah, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Something else I wanted to ask you about the new album. When people buy the album, they can buy a bundle that includes a plushie toy that's designed from Anthony Osgang, who you've worked with Anthony previously on like artworks for albums and things like that. Is that right?
Yeah, he did the album cover for Congratulations. And we've known him for a long time.
What is a plushie toy to anybody who has no idea? And what does it look like? Because I was looking at the website thinking, wow, this is I've never seen a band bundle together this and like the new vinyl edition of their album. So like... Tell me more, basically.
Well, I mean, it's sort of also another nod to something that was not like a direct part. I didn't collect them or anything. But like when I was growing up, there was an era of the Beanie Baby. And they're these little stuffed plushy bears. And they became like like they would like, they started like culture wars, and some of them were like selling for, you know, like $20,000 and all of this crazy stuff. And so that's just like embedded in my head as something that is just totally normal. And so we made a plushie for a Little Dark Age. We made like the kind of the one out of the guy from the cover, the drawing. And then I just was thinking like, it'd be so fun to do a series, you know, and have them be collectible. So this is going to be a collectible bubblegum dog one that is sort of this surreal deconstructed children's teddy bear dog thing.
I was going to say that has faces on both paws.
Yeah, we're ripping
it
off.
It does, but it's really cute though.
We're kind of ripping off this teddy bear that was designed by Philippe Starck in the 90s. That has that. It's like a bear, but then like one appendage is like a different animal, and yeah, we're kind of just ripping it off, but it's really fun. It's not like that's like a big thing that people know.
No, exactly. And it's like, you're right, it's scary cute. It's like cute until you realize you're like, there's something else at play here.
Yeah,
and loss of life, like I absolutely love it. Christine and the Queens joins you on the album on a track called Dancing in Babylon. How did you get to do did you get to do that together? And where did that collaboration come from?
We didn't record it together in the same place, but when we were working on the album and that song was taking shape, it got to a point where it went from being this kind of skip along, lighthearted 90s sort of thing, loosely about a young couple called Catherine and Bobby. And then it sort of just kept changing and evolving, and the music, eventually the bed of music kind of took on this 80s ballad feeling. And then really it started feeling like this is going to be a duet, like a call, you know, call and response kind of thing. And at that point when we were like in the world of 80s ballad duet, Christine and the Queens, his voice was like something we both thought of pretty quickly. There had been opportunities over the years where we both wanted to collaborate, and it never really worked out the timing wise. So this was like the time to do it. And he was really into it. And while the music, I think, is a lot different from what he's been releasing, it's sort of shares a similar sentiment and kind of theme on the importance of love, I think. So yeah, it kind of just came together pretty nicely.
It's a beautiful track. My other favorites on the album, People on the Streets and Nothing Changes, is just amazing. I wanted to ask a bit about, because I'm aware we're coming towards our end of our time together today, you're more than like 20 years in at this point in MGMT. How do you feel like you know everything about each other at this point, like creatively and just randomly?
I mean, in some ways, yes, because I mean, we're basically like siblings at this point, or like, you know, we've like grown up together in a lot of ways, but we've also been living on separate coasts for a while. And I think we've both like, I would like to say that we've both chilled out as people in the last few years. I think especially like the pandemic years, I think we've kind of like really focused more on just like domestic life and like the simpler things and kind of getting back to basics a little bit. So it's been nice to like, especially it's been nice to like approach making music together again, just from that perspective of like, you know, getting rid of a lot of the extra crap and just kind of getting back to our roots a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about you, Andrew? What surprises you about Ben still? Is it like, what's the best, like most unpopular opinion that Ben has about like a band or a film or something that you're just like, how do you not love that? Or why do you think that's good?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to say something specific like that, but it, I think, since we've known each other and we've been friends and collaborating for half of our lives, it's surprising and like heartening and kind of incredible to me that we come together and really like we've been doing the same thing since we were 20, where every time we work together is like a little mini epic journey where we both are rediscovering each other, learning how to kind of work together and like compromise, but also hold strong to our gut feelings. And then that kind of all morphs into what this next MGMT sound and experiment is going to be. And I think the fact that we're never trying to recreate and are somewhat consciously trying not to like do the same thing again, it keeps it so that our relationship can stay fresh and we're still learning about each other every time. And I'm just happy that, you know, we haven't tried one of these experiments out and come away being like, you know, screw that guy. Like, he's really an asshole now. No, it's like, we're kind of like, you know, we both learn every time, which is really great.
And last question, what's your plans for 2024, apart from obviously releasing this new album? Are you going to do some shows? And if you do, are you going to bring the giant cowbell with you? what are your plans?
We don't really know. I mean, I think one thing that we have told ourselves for a very long time is that what we would love to do is finish an album and just start working on the next one right away. And I don't know what it takes to make that happen or if that will happen. I know that, you know, there's a certain amount of like promo and whatever that that inevitably happens when you put out an album. But I really would like to keep, I feel like we're in a very good creative space right now, and I would love to keep that going.
Well, listen, thank you to both of you for coming on the podcast. Let's not leave it another 17 years to speak. And yeah, it's been great hearing about everything and the new album, and I can't wait for people to hear it.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you. Good to see you again.
Midnight Chats is a joint production between Loud and Quiet and Atomized Studios for iHeartRadio.
It's hosted by Stuart Stubbs and Greg Cochran, mixed and mastered by Flo Lines, and edited by Stuart Stubbs.
Find us on Instagram and TikTok to watch clips from our recordings and much, much more. We are Midnight Chats Pod.
For more information, visit loudandquiet.com.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Good, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.